third day, he will be raised to life. And down. What is it you want? She said, grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom. You don't know what you are asking, Jesus said to them. Can you drink the cup I am going to drink? We can, they answered. He said to them, you will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father. When the 10 heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Jesus called them together and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Kids are invited to kids' church, but as they go down, though, you'll notice that I think Kelly, Emily, and Emily are all staying in the service today, which might be the first time in forever, which means thank you, Zane and Jeremy, for teaching today. That's a wonderful transition. It's a buzzer. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. This is, as Emily pointed out, moving through our story with the Gospel of Matthew, and we're reaching, this is the third and final passion prediction. Instantly after this scene, Jesus will heal two blind men and then enter Jerusalem for Palm Sunday, which is what we'll have here next week. Although I want to focus as we go into Palm Sunday next week on those two blind men that sort of come in with him, because I think it expands the teaching that we have here. But then Palm Sunday starts Holy Week. There's events of Holy Week in the bulletin that you can look at. Most importantly, the Good Friday service, because we try to not do Palm and Passion Sunday together, although there's a mix of that. What happened is that it used to be that Good Friday was a holy fast day. Nobody could work, and everybody went to church actually at noon on Good Friday, and they all went and they heard the story. Today, it's hard to get people out for Good Friday service. I understand that. We're busy. Church comes from a wide area, but it's important for us to hear that as we walk into Easter joy. And so next Sunday, I'll probably have some of the elements of reminding us that Palm and Passion Sunday have been squished together because of the busyness of modern life. But it's for us to hopefully and prayerfully, if we can, come together that Friday to hear that story. More than the sermon or anything else, I think, to hear that story. And I have bookmarks I made for the year that we did it with Mark in the back that I'll put out next week as well, if you can't make it, to sort of be able to read through those stories during the Holy Week. Because for the light of Easter to shine bright, we have to hear of the darkness that comes with it. We can't just skip that as much as we might want to. And so that's where we're heading. But this teaching this Sunday first has that third prediction of his what's going to come in Passion Week. I mean, you could in a sense read this as the table of contents of what we're going to be doing all of Holy Week. It's all right here, condensed in form. And Jesus teaches this to his disciples and sort of points over that he is going to be one who is handed over. Part of what I think happens in this third teaching and what happens when the mother of the sons of Zebedee comes and asks this question, can they sit at your right and your left, is an expansion on that. So this teaching about here's what's going to happen in Jerusalem, and then this question is not there so that we can be like, well, at least we didn't have our mom make that mistake, but is there to say, what is the shape of the thing that's going to happen as we go forward. So it's something that I'm sure really happened, but also a teaching that guides us into understanding where to we might go wrong in looking at this passage and apply it in ways. And so Jesus gives this third and final passion and announcement here at the edge of entering into his final week. And he's handed over, I wanted to say, in this cup that he talks about drinking, which we'll get to, it has this sense, has a lot of different applications for it. I think the one that many Christians are familiar with is that he's handed over in the sense that Israel is handed over. When Israel chooses its own sinful path, chooses to direct its own ways, chooses idolatry, chooses to forget its story, it then is handed over by God to sort of get the fruits of what it wanted. So I think it's an interesting sort of way, if we think of the sinful life as sort of this turning against God and then God judges us, it's often, it seems like biblically the case is, it's this turning against God that has its natural roots and you being handed over to whatever it is you want to give into. The judgment is almost in what you want to do. I choose to spend my life in an alcoholic haze. I choose to spend my life consuming content that I know is disforming to my soul. I choose to spend my life worshiping things that will ask human sacrifice of me over time that harms my human relationships. Hand it over. God doesn't need active judgment any more than to say, you reap what you sow. You're going to get what you have. But here, applied to Christ, it has this sense in which he, as the one who has not committed any of these things, is handed over to what humanity has chosen. That's why I think, we'll allude to it a couple times, but that reading that Brian read for us from Isaiah 53 has this sense in which Christ becomes that for us, which we cannot be for ourselves. And in that sense, when he bears that burden, when he is redemption for us, we are redeemed to God. This is that ransom at the end of the passage. But in that first pass, this is the first time Jesus says is that he's handed over in this way on his way to Jerusalem. But then the Zebedee's moms come up. This is the passage we just talked about. On the third day, he will be raised to life. Then the mother of the son of Zebedee's came to Jesus with her sons and kneeling down asked a favor of him. I read the commentaries, lots of them. They're never funny. But this one, Thomas Long started the next paragraph with a masterpiece of bad timing. The sons, and I, in my study, I just laughed because they're never funny. But I was like, yes, masterpiece of bad timing would be Jesus has, in the previous parable, taught about how the reward is the same for those who come last as those who come first, that God is gracious in ways we can't imagine. He predicts his death, and then this poor woman walks up. In Mark's gospel, he actually blames the sons themselves. Matthew sort of puts it on her. She walks up in a masterpiece of bad timing. And yet her masterpiece of bad timing, I think, is good for us and our souls to have that. She walks up and she asks a favor of him. What is it you want? He asks. Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom. First, to give some fair context to this, she's asking for what they can have in this coming kingdom. I mean, she believes that there is a coming kingdom, that this kingdom will have some form to it, it will have content, and it will have content such that it would be valuable maybe for her sons to have a higher place in it. That she might be wrong about, but I think as Christians we read this and we go, wow, she really doesn't get it. But we live our lives half-heartedly, often not believing in the kingdom at all. She believes in the kingdom so much that she's trying to arrange a good structure for her sons in it. Maybe not as good, but there's that deep belief that this kingdom is going to come. And she wants one to sit at the right and the left, which is the sort of places of power, as we're familiar with. You do not know what you are asking, Jesus said. Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink? I don't know if this is a masterpiece of bad timing for James and John, but they say we can. Maybe not getting what's coming either, because it's quite clear that only that full cup is the one that Jesus can drink. He'll talk later about them having their own taste of the cup, but it's not the same cup that he drinks. But before we move further, I wanted to do just a little experiment. I learned this from Arthur Brooks, who wrote a book, Strength to Strength. I think it's on the New York Times bestselling list right now, about aging. That's good news for me. Middle life crisis stuff. This is from Thomas Aquinas. He said, these are the four idols that you're going to struggle with in your life. Now, you may think, I have one that's not on this list, and that's completely fine. But for the sake of this experiment, Aquinas thought you could reduce them to these four. What Arthur Brooks does with his students at Stanford is he says, which one are you least interested in? Which one has the least power over you? Which is the one that you're least willing to go towards? Strike that one off. Now, what is the next one that you're least interested in? Strike that one off. And then for the third one, it's the one you're least interested in of what's remaining. I mean, these are hierarchical, so that's pretty close to the center of who you are, but not the exact center, or at least something you're craving after. And then that last one, he tells his students at Stanford, that according to Aquinas, the doctor of the church, is what your soul is going to struggle with, idolatry as an idol for you. That's what you're going to cling to. And I don't think they're the same for everyone. But as he went through this, I was listening to that interview on a run, and I was like, I don't get it. And then it's one of those things that, and so you may not get it today because I didn't get it in the context, but I thought about it for a long time. And then I started to think, okay, yeah, no, I have a pretty clear ranking of one, two, three, and four are kind of interchangeable for me. But one and two, I can see the seeds of my destruction sowed an idol that makes up one and two. And then for that, Christ, for us, as Christ is the doctor of our souls, to invite him in to begin to healing that. And so if this question that the mother of the sons of Zebedee asks is a question probably more about honor, will they have this honor in this place in the kingdom? Christ's solution for that is that then they would become servants or slaves of all, that they would move into that space. And you could see quite clearly how that is the case with honor. Now, I don't want to say that the other three have different answers. Christ quite clearly commands this one answer to us, but I do think it might be worth, if you'd pick money per se, to say that there is a gospel teaching. You could pick many of them. You can't serve two masters. You can't serve God and money. You could pick another teaching and say, that's the one that perhaps I need to bring into my life and to find some healing in. With lust and pleasure and drink, you could find a New Testament teaching with honor and power. But Aquinas, I think, is quite right that one of these four, maybe you could add two or three more, although I think many of our choice sins fit under these four categories. And then it's that idol that pulls hardest at us. And then it's weird, too, of course, because we don't understand people who don't struggle with the other one. Which is for the church to be like, this is mine, it may not be yours. And then we have grace sometimes for people who struggle with ours, but not for ones who struggle with other ones. And so to see that there's more roots to this, that you may not be one who's after money, and so those people seem insane or lost to you, but you have your own afflictedness in this. And that Christ here offers an example to work with honor, maybe with all four of them. You could see how lowering yourself and being a servant might actually help with all four of these too. If you're going to do that, your money's not going to come as well. Pleasure may get deflated some in your ability to serve others, and so might your power. But again, I think there are also other New Testament teachings that we can apply to our souls to grow in this, these four idols that come to us. And I think probably come back to that. Jesus said to me, you will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or your left hand is not for me to grant. These places belong to those whom they have been prepared for by my Father. Obviously, many Christians who are familiar with the story will instantly think of the two criminals on his right and his left, whom Bart calls the first Christian community. The first church is there born at the cross, which gives you a sense of what we've signed up for to some degree. But he says, you will indeed drink from my cup, that there will be a sacrifice for them. James, if you read into the book of Acts, is martyred in the book of Acts. John gets exiled to an island and gives us the book of the Revelation, which has its own joys for sure, but is not like, we read it and it's a hard book to read. His vision that he has is not exactly the reassuring vision that you want, is that the two things you will be granted if you follow me, the cup you'll taste, is martyrdom and exile. Reminds me of the story of Rosario Butterfield. I looked this up, in one of her earlier testimonies, she was asked to give up much to become a Christian. And she said, so when I went to church, and this is terrifying, she went to other people at her church and said, she said to them, what did you give up to be here? What did it cost you to walk into this room? I may have one of those obvious sins in which you can sort of point out and say, give this up, alcoholism, drink, this, whatever. But what did you have to give up to be here? And what Rosario said, which I find interesting, is people had the most painful and heart-wrenching stories about what they had to give up. Once they had to sit with and think about it, what did they have to give up to be in the room? What did they have to give up to sort of take up to say that I've drunk from this cup as well? Because as we know, the Christian life isn't exempt from those pains and those hurts, those things we have to leave behind. Going back to those four idols too, that like I had to give up my pursuit of pleasure in these ways. And you imagine pleasure of living my life through my children. You know, it's not all just negative things. I had to give up the upward mobility track, and in the phrase of Henry Nouwen, embrace downward mobility. So, you know, I gave up a raise. I gave up a move. I gave up being busier in some sense so I could have the path of downward mobility. You too will taste this cup. What did you give up to be here, and how is it going with those four idols yourself as you look at your own soul? And then when the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with the two brothers. Together, Jesus called them together and said, it was Fleming Rutledge who said, he calls them together for this patient reorientation. As they're sort of like lost in this, who's going to be right or left? That might be their concern. They might be concerned that the brothers don't get it. They might be concerned that these brothers are trying to sort of usurp them in the kingdom and then have them underneath them. Whatever it might be, they become indignant. And Jesus, in his wisdom, calls them together for a patient reorientation. Now, I like that way of looking at it, because I looked at it more as like the halftime coach when you're down 40-0, and he's like, did you learn anything? What is wrong with all of you? Christ instead calls them together for a patient reorientation, which seems to fit his character more. What he says to them, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority of them. Not so with you. There's a whole theology and world summarized in that, not so with you. The Christians are those who are to see how the world works, how the Gentiles work, how these things are lorded over one another, and then to hear from Jesus, not so with you. And I think what we can hear in that is not the invitation to a different social program, a different way of doing these things, a different way of making sure it works, that like a book on servant leadership should go into all the institutions, and that is, I mean, I'm not against that these values have gone out into the world in other ways, but Christ is about creating a different community that's not bound by the politics of death and destruction, and that opens up different avenues for us that we couldn't exist in the first place, that he invites them into a community and a way of life that's contrasting with that. And it doesn't contain in it the promise that it'll work. I'm about to go up to Jerusalem and be crucified. You too will taste of this cup. Not so with you. I was on a call with some Mennonite pastors this week, and we're talking about the language of pacifism and how in MCUSA, the previous denomination we were part of, in many places, it becomes this sort of social strategy to rid the world from pain. If that's what it was, I would have never signed up for it in my first place. But if it is the call to live and follow Jesus, despite the knowing what the outcomes might bring, then it's a call to faithfulness. It's not a strategy that is meant to work. And if we look at the history of those who have embraced it at many times, it doesn't work. And so we have to live into that. Now, I was in a leadership class in seminary, and this is maybe an example of why you shouldn't have leadership classes at seminary. Because we watched the movie The Mission. Has anybody seen the movie The Mission? And because the guy leading it was more of a businessman, had a business mindset at least watching that movie more than a Christian or whatever you want to say, watched it. At the end of the movie is the priest played by Jeremy Irons sort of walking out to confront the Spanish army in prayer and singing, and they're massacred as a result of that. A different character who sort of has his soul healed from his own violent passions throughout the movie, played by Robert De Niro, sort of wants to fight them. Both of them die. And the professor asked, he said, I just watched this film and think it didn't have to be this way. We could have negotiated better. And I thought, this is like, could you miss the point more? Like that the church has room for martyrdom. The word witness, which Emily reminded us that, you know, to be a witness to the, it also is the same word as the word martyr. So congrats, I didn't tell you that. But the church has room for martyrdom. Like not all was lost in that moment. And actually what happens is it goes back to Spain and something does change as a result of it. But he viewed this as like a problem of negotiation, that Christianity and the art of pastoring is this way of like making everybody win. And there's this middle piece in which, you know, you get to abuse, but we get to worship, and it just works out well in the end. Not so with you. Called into this path in so many different ways, and we're not promised that it'll work or that we'll be able to find a compromise. We're promised essentially that we're going to drink from his cup as well. Exile, martyrdom, lostness, what did it cost you to be here? The path of downward mobility, the lostness that comes with that. And yet knowing that Christ and the church are there with us in that way. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must become your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Jesus, if honor is the one, this is good medicine, I think, for those who pursue honor. I think it's good medicine for all of them, like I said. But this kingdom in which Christ is bringing is calling people into not seeking the highest places, but to live freely. Again, the phrase... He has brought to an end of our slavery of the politics based on the fear of death, making it possible us to be servants to one another and the world. He's brought to an end a way of being in the world based on the fear of death. You can be last. You can serve. You can move in other ways. This is the second thing about that, going back to the peace discussion. It's possible because of Christ. Like, you can't excerpt this ethic from relationship and living within him and have it be the same. Because the politics of death still rules if that's the case. But it's because the Son of Man has risen that we have new possibilities available to us. So much so that we can go as far as the priest leading the children out in prayer to face an army. And not signing up for that. But it is within our realm as people who know more than we think, who are opened up to more than we think we could have been. Just as the Son of Man did not come to serve, but to be served. I didn't check, but this is a common complaint of Jesus on the cross, is that he came to save others, but he cannot save himself. He did not come to be served, but to serve. In the mocking tone, but it's near exactly, he came to save others, but he cannot save himself. Because he came as one who came to be served, or came to serve rather than be served, it opens up a path for us to be freed for that and to give his life as a ransom for many. This is the last part of this. This is a heavy part because you get into what is the cross for and how is the cross supposed to function? What does it mean to give up your life as a ransom for many? There's this notion that the ransom has to be paid to someone. That's common in Christianity. The early church, oddly, and thought that the ransom was paid to the devil, that the humanity was in the clutches of Satan. And Jesus, like Aslan, this is an interesting thing, like Aslan in the Chronicles of Narnia says, look, you can give humanity back to God, and I'll go as a willing victim in his place. And Satan says, the Son of God, better deal than all of humanity, I'll take it. Not realizing that, as Aslan says, that while there was one magic, there's a deeper magic still, that when an innocent victim goes in the place of guilty victims, that victim is raised up to new life. That was the early church's idea, was paid to Satan. In the Middle Ages, they think, how can Satan own anything? So that one sort of goes away. In the Reformation tradition, we have this idea that this is paid to God, that the ransom is paid to God, and God takes the willing sacrifice of Jesus. And they work this out together. I think one of the reasons why people push back on this is they have this sense in which God sort of pushes Jesus just to the cross, and there's no trinity or no unity between them. But this is a willing mission undertaken by all three characters of the Trinity. So it's not just like, you're the sacrifice and I'm this, and but this mission to rescue humanity back, and so that what we've done is paid for Christ and his blood to sort of free us. That's another theory. And I wanted to just bring up the quote from Flannery O'Connor that's on the back of the bulletin today, which is, there's something in us as storytellers and as listeners to stories that demands the redemptive act, that demands that what falls at least be offered the chance to be restored. The reader of today's books, the reader today looks for this motion, and rightly so, but what he has forgotten is the cost of it. His sense of evil is diluted or lacking altogether, and he has forgotten the price of restoration. The Son of Man gives himself as a ransom for many. We, I think, the church today, because there are wars over this language, has forgotten the cost of it. But what I want to say is I don't think we actually can work it all out. This is Robert Fair Capon, who said, one real thing is closer to God than all the diagrams in the world. One real thing is closer to God than all the diagrams in the world. In seminary, every seminarian gets obsessed with working out one sort of problem. For some reason, I was obsessed with atonement, this doctrine of how does Christ reconcile us. So I studied every doctrine of the atonement, and what I ended with is the one real thing of what Christ does to us, for us, is more real than all the diagrams and atonement theories in the world. Substitutionary atonement, if you're familiar with that, Christ is victor, that Christ is the victor over all things. The ransom atonement, where Christ pays to the devil for our thing. All those are fine diagrams. But the one real thing is that Christ is there for the many. And so I was listening to Ayan Hirsch Ali, who was a Muslim, grew up in Somalia. Somalia gets taken over by radical Muslims. I believe she's abused at that point, flees to another country, lives in Denmark as a politician for a while, becomes a prominent member of the new atheist movement, sort of criticizing all of religion based on her Islamic experience. Her friend is murdered in Denmark, and instead of shutting up and hiding, she moves to England and the States and hangs out with Richard Dawkins and thinks following God is a giant mistake. In the last year, a little bit longer, she's become a Christian for weird reasons, but she's become a Christian. And if you listen to the deeper part of her testimony, she says it was preceded by suffering and depression and mental anguish. That she had tried therapy, she had tried to self-medicate. She said, I drank enough alcohol to sterilize a hospital. I did all these things, and I imagined I'd shut down the spiritual part of my life. And she said that a therapist asked her, you know, could she open back up the spiritual part of her life? And she said, you know, here's my experience with Islam. Being a woman is terrible, this, that, and the other, this, that, and the other. And she said, what if you could imagine God? What would you imagine? And she said, I began to think that God would look like Jesus Christ. That if I were to design a God myself, it would have the ideals of Christianity within it. And so she slowly started to surrender into that, to go to church. And it's amazing the way she speaks about what happened, because she was freed from that condition in some ways. But she doesn't talk about like there's joy or happiness. I mean, that may come for her, but just that like that anguish and that hole that was inside of her doesn't rule anymore. The reason I bring that up is because one real thing is closer to God than all the diagrams in the world. Ayan Hirsch Ali, can you define the Trinity, how the atonement works, name all 66 books of the Bible, this, that, and the other? Probably not at this point. But can she find herself hearing? Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. To find herself in the experience of the many. Let us pray. God, you have instructed your disciples again of the path in which you will walk, that you're going up to Jerusalem and you will be handed over for what you did not commit, but how humanity has sought to self-define itself. God, in hearing that, we prepare ourselves for Holy Week and the stories of what we are going to hear about humanity as it hands you over and you are tossed from palace to palace, place to place, trial to trial, and ultimately put to death. We hear then on Easter of your good news of resurrection, but in the meantime, allow us to sit with this question. Where will we be in the kingdom? What do we think of its shapes and contours? How do we battle with those things in our soul, ourselves? And can we invite you in as the doctor of our souls to invite us into being last, to serving, to being the slave of others? And to hear that this starts with you, who did not come to be served, but to serve, who came to save others, but could not save himself, and who gives himself up as a ransom for many. I ask this in the name of the Father, and Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.